on my mind. Time after time, I see reflections of you and me. Reflections of the way life used to be. Reflections of the love you took from me.
We have with us today someone we've been hoping to speak to for a really long time. It's a gentleman named Matt who runs the website 2001 False Flag Odyssey. We've discussed it a few times in this show before. I'm going to, of course, link the website up in the show notes. And it might be helpful for anyone listening, if you haven't checked this website out already, to read the article that he has there. It's basically one kind of piece that you can read in a single sitting is the material on the website, and it's really informative. I didn't even realize how informative till I read your article just before going to see 2001 on the big screen and was able to verify a lot of the details that it's hard to see on a small screen. I was able to verify a lot of those details, and it was just I found it really, really helpful to be able to notice more. So I really hope everyone checks that out. If you don't do so before the show, do so thereafter. And maybe we could just start off on the website. You're writing as a gentleman named Joe, but your real name is Matt. That's what we're going to refer to you as today. Maybe you just want to kind of start there.
Yeah, as far as, well, Joe Bisden is an anagram. And I'll leave it up to the listeners to maybe decipher what that is, in the same kind of way that Heywood Floyd is actually an anagram for Defy Hollywood, which I guess has its own interpretations. Maybe Kubrick is saying Defy Hollywood, but that, I guess that's a whole nother tangent. This website, like I said, wrote it in around 2008, at around the same time that I was waking up to a lot of the, might say, the conspiratorial nature of things. There's inevitably, well, I guess it's not so inevitable, but it does tie to 9/11 and similar false flag type of events that governments tend to use to control their own people and to get them into, maybe going to war or these various types of things. So as I was going through my own awakening in the real world, I happened to stumble across this in Kubrick's work. And it was largely motivated by Rob Egger, which I know you guys have spoken about before, who was also writing about and investigating 2001 at around the same time. And there was correspondences that I've had with him. And actually, if you go to his site, he does credit me as Matt Pulver in the development of that work. It was actually from him. I mean, he has a unique background in both film and psychology. And I think combining these two things together, which is really what allowed him to almost kind of interpret Kubrick's movies as a dream, in more of a not a Freudian sense, but
a Jungian sense. He threw in Jung's Red Book in The Shining on Ullman's desk.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, that's who I was looking for. It's a funny thing with this movie 2001. It seems like whatever stage of life that I've been at, that is how I interpret the film. I think I first decided, I can't remember how old I was, maybe around somewhere from 9 to 13 or something, but when I first saw this movie, I just knew that it had a profound message. I didn't understand, I knew I didn't know what it was saying at the time, but I just knew it was profound. I think through high school, when I started thinking about, say, consciousness and the whole philosophical problems of consciousness in kind of the Cartesian mind-body duality problem, I was interpreting the monolith as, say, consciousness. And, you know, the dawn of man, I thought they were discovering, the monolith was kind of a representation of them discovering their own consciousness and the mystery of it, and all this kind of stuff. And then, you know, lo and behold, later on when I am learning about, I guess you might say, conspiracy, for lack of a better word, just that I'm finding these same themes, which I do believe are deliberately in the movie. And so my focus on, I guess, even the title, False Flag Odyssey, I think this part of the motivation why I took that particular angle is also just to help wake others up, I guess, in the same way that other people have helped to wake me up to what's going on. And, you know, I've since gone, you know, beyond that. I don't want to just instill fear. I mean, I think this is kind of a doorway into a much broader world of enlightenment and, you know, understanding polarity and, you know, and even getting into more esoteric things such as the Kabbalah that I want to talk to you guys about. That's kind of, I don't know, maybe one introduction there.
Awesome.
So you had sent to me an email, just to go to that original point. So the Joe Bizton sort of alias was kind of, I don't want to put a thing on it, but or I hope you don't take this the wrong way. I mean this as a fully sympathetic way of perhaps almost like a paranoid, not wanting to put your real name out there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I was more paranoid at the time, and I wanted to kind of, yeah, get the word out without associating my name with it. But, you know, since then, I think this is the time to shine our truth and to, you know, to express what we have learned and share it with others without fear. So that's kind of more, we're closer to where I'm at now.
Here, here. That's, I mean, like I said, I mean that fully sympathetically. I was there myself, so...
Yeah,
it's so funny that, of course, it would tie into this very thing in 2001, False Flag. I mean, this is the sort of dawn of the paranoid man, you know, in one sense.
So John Fell Ryan just put up a post on Facebook of Kubrick's Vanity Fair article, which I'd never read before, from a close friend of his who was recounting Kubrick. And he made a statement in there that I really liked about Kubrick's reaction to a William S. Burroughs line where he said a paranoid schizophrenic is somebody who just woke up or somebody who just realized what's going on. And I really liked that, and it felt like, yeah, I could see how that he could appreciate that when you look at some of the stuff he's put out there.
Then the fact that Kubrick resonated with that idea so much implies that Kubrick himself was no stranger to paranoia.
Oh yeah,
which I think is pretty evident in his films. So maybe, you know, totally however you want to kind of go about doing this, but what I'd like to do is kind of start breaking down some of the material you cover in there.
Great.
You know, for one, your idea of the, you know, maybe we can go to the interpretations later, but there's a set of observations which are undeniable. Things like the constant mirroring or flipping of images throughout the film.
Right.
And I guess there, so you make one point about the, when Frank is running through the sort of hamster wheel of the space station, or rather Discovery, how that keeps flipping. You make another point about the patch on Dave Bowman's uniform, and that's something that's harder for me to see what you mean by that. Can you kind of go into a little more detail about that patch?
Yeah. So before getting there, let me just address, if I may, the when Frank Poole is running around the centrifuge, which, you know, kind of looks like a hamster wheel, as you said, there's four scenes there, or four cuts, I guess you might say. So the first cut, when you first see him running around, is actually normal. It's not reversed. It's the true way it should be. And then there's three more cuts, all of which are reversed.
How do you know it's the normal way?
Okay, great. Yeah, so there's one of the main, you might say, landmark, I guess, or there's a group of three people in hibernation, where two are on one side and one is on the other. And so that's, once you can establish which is which, then that is something that is in all four of those scenes that you can kind of tell. So the question comes down to, how do you establish which image is the correct one? And there's one scene where in the movie later on, when David, like a continuous shot in which he walks from those three hibernation tanks down to one of the computer monitors, and there's words on the computer monitor. And so that is where you can tell whether or not you're looking at a mirror image or not. So from that you can then, you know, piece back to those four scenes and establish which are correct and which are not. Okay, I do have an interpretation, but like you said, like, why is Kubrick doing that? But we could get back to that later. To answer your question about the flag. Okay, so the reason I brought that up was just to establish this is in fact going on and can be, you know, directly confirmed, which is non-controversial. The flag, it's a bit ambiguous. It's not really clear, and Kubrick may have done this deliberately, because there's a convention with the flag. So, okay, if you go to the site, you know, 2001: A False Flag Odyssey, at the very top, the first image is David Bowman kind of looking at Hal with very suspicious eyes, and on his right shoulder is an eagle with an American flag on it, and the American flag is pointed down with the blue and white in the upper left-hand corner. And so if you, say, rotate that 90 degrees clockwise, it would be a reversed flag. However, that in itself is not so unusual, in that if you look at, I don't know if it's in the House of Representatives or what, but in one of the main houses of the U.S. government, there is a flag behind where the main speakers speak, where the flag is vertical. And so when the red and white stripes are vertical, it's convention that the blue rectangle still goes in the upper left. So that would appear to be a reversed image of the flag, but it's just by convention that it should go in the upper left-hand corner. Now, to add one more thing to that, in case, just to really kind of belabor the point, but in a marching band, when soldiers are marching and they are holding a flag in front of them, if you're, say, in a parade, if you're on the left-hand side of the street, facing the same direction they are, like, they're going to have a flag that is, say, pointing back towards them because the wind is going back. So if they have a flag, a patch of a flag on their left shoulder, it should match the flag, which would look correct. However, if they have a patch on their right shoulder, and you could confirm this by just looking at any military man that has an American flag on their right shoulder, it should be reversed because it has to match how the flag looks when they're marching with it. And this has been written in their, I guess, some code of conduct or whatnot. So in Bowman's case, we have two effects on the same. He has a patch on his right shoulder, but it's vertical. So, you know, it's which way should the flag be? Like, so is it a false flag or is it not false flag? I'm not going to take a stance, I guess, to what Kubrick actually intended, but you know, that's a possibility. I'll just put it that way.
Sure.
Well, the reason that strikes me is, again, you know, we're kind of sticking with, you know, and again, there's no convention here. We could kind of do this however you want, but just to stick with the observation to begin with, no meaning implied just yet. I love the idea that your site is talking about false flags, and it's, you center here on that idea, is it a flag in the official normal sense, or is it a false version of that? Like, the play on false flag is so, right, in a sense, a literal play on words, that it's just an awesome sort of entry point into this.
Thanks.
So then then there's this other idea of these things being flipped, which, when, if you read this article and then watch the film, you can notice that those those tanks are definitely being reversed.
Oh, yeah.
And then you make the point that the hoses, later in the film, the hose, what side the hose comes out of the helmet and goes into the, I guess, air tank or whatever on their back would be, that also switches a few times. And that would imply, you know, anything else that you want to, if someone, a skeptic, wanted to argue, oh, it's Kubrick made a mistake, even though he's said to be this perfect craftsman, he can make mistakes. The fact, if you had hoses on different sides of the helmet, would imply that they had to manufacture two different costumes for the movie. Like a very intentional choice to make two different versions of the outfit.
Yeah, or they just flip the film.
Yeah, and you don't accidentally flip a film, you know.
Right. So, okay, so there's never a flipped hose where you see lettering. Because I would say, as you pointed out, if it was just a flipped image, which would be a very easy thing to do, then you would notice that the text was written backwards, as if reading in a mirror or something.
Yeah, and that might be the case in one of the last scenes in the Renaissance room. Some people call it the White Room, in which it appears as if David is looking in a mirror, and he has a hose. But you can actually make out the word discovery on one of the emblems. So there might be points where the hose and lettering are in the same scene.
One of my favorite things you pointed out was when he's showing Hal the sketches, and right. You can see that he's hiding. Like, it's so apparent after reading your thing. I mean, it was a number of months ago when I read it, but I watched 2001 specifically to just look through at all the points that you were making to see if I could see it in live action. And that was, like, really, really redefined that scene. Because, you know, it's like, he knows when he's looking at Hal that Hal's not just an eye, he's also the eye of everybody back. He's basically, you know, Houston and the CIA or whatever, and they're watching what's going on in the ship. So he's, like, keeping his composure and not letting on, whereas Frank does let on that he's duped, whereas Dave doesn't seem to be as duped in the same way, and you can see where that gets him as opposed to Frank.
Yeah, and he's actually drawing a sketch of those three hibernation tanks, which we can use as a marker in the audience to tell which scene is flipped or not. And that's, out of all the drawings that Dave does, that is the most detailed, it's the most 3D. And when Hal asks him to see what drawings he has been doing, he hides his best one and just shows him all these other childlike, more two-dimensional drawings.
These are very nice renderings, Dave. The Predator was something that the leopard, when I first got into this article, because I didn't know what I was in for, and I've read a lot of different articles that there's points that I really resonate with and recognize, and there's points where, like, well, that's a stretch. That was what I looked at as an initial stretch, but upon rewatching the film and rereading the article, I realized that is, like, actually indisputable, that the leopard is the top of the power, what you say, the apex of power in your article. And those, the way that his eyes are actually, that they glow, I can see that. Like, I can see what you're communicating. And the fact that they're all hiding at night, and then later on, you know, after they figure out how to use the bone, you know, they're not. They're, like, hanging out. Like, they've established their dominant role in the area.
Established in strength.
Yeah, established in Oz.
Sure. I also want to say, yeah, I mean, I remember the first time reading your article, I have to admit, like, some of it I'm like, okay, whatever. Like, some of it, it's like excellent points, and some of it's like, well, that could totally be a stretch. Yeah. And I don't know if I agree with where this guy's going with there. And then, excuse me, you read your article and then watch it, there are things that I just found myself nodding along going, oh, shit, this guy is right. I mean, particularly like the for me, when you mentioned the photographer's cufflinks as resonating with the leopard, I'm like, oh, come on, you know. And yeah. then I watch and I'm like, oh shit, no, okay, yeah, that's a really incredibly valid and valuable interpretation.
The way that it's emphasized, I mean, it's not just that they're there, it's that it's like putting it in your face in an intentional way, what feels like an intentional way. And so it's like, don't miss this, you know?
Yeah, if I could say something on that, I mean, is it okay if I jump into some interpretations now?
Go for it.
Anytime.
So the question is, I guess, why, you know, what's the connection between the leopard and the photographer? And I would say this resonates with the, when the bone is thrown up in the air, right? The bone is a weapon, but then in a few scenes after that, you see the bone rotating, but then also Heywood Floyd's pen is rotating, right? And so the woman brings the pen or catches the pen in the air and puts it back in Heywood Floyd's pocket. So
the pen is mightier than the bone. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, this has become, we're living now in an information war, right? Back then it was a physical war over resources, and now it's an information war over resources again, but instead of the pool of water, right, it's Frank Pool, right? Mm-hmm. The pool is now human resources that the battle is waged over and that conquerors are after, you know, for, you know, what, anything, everything from income tax to, you know, testing new medical things. I mean, it's all, you know, that's a whole another thing. So this tie, how does this tie into the photographer? That, so the, again, the photographer is part of this information war because he is shooting, right, through photography, you create a story that gets put into the newspapers and, you know, you're creating propaganda. And so that's, you know, I think that's the connection there.
I sent you an email a number of months ago where I, after I read this article, and I was like, pointed out by Jake Kotza, I wouldn't know it if it wasn't for him, was the Millennium Hilton right in front of the Two Towers. Right. That is modeled, admittedly so, to represent the monolith. And what I hadn't seen pointed out by him after he pointed that out was that you have this, as Heywood Floyd is walking down the corridor in the satellite or whatever, what is that, space station, you can see the Hilton sign on the side on glass with a desk that looks an awful lot like the monolith. You know, with a little paper airplane type situation inside there too. The fact that it's called the Millennium Hilton in the first place, the fact, like, all of these things all together, and like that feels to me like the, as far as I can tell, like the ultimate false flag event that our generation is in touch with. 2001, I mean, come on, like that felt pretty direct.
Yeah. Yeah. I listened to, when you guys spoke about that before, I mean, I agree with what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. I appreciated that you actually wrote me back. A lot of times I'll write people and I don't get a response, but, actually acknowledged that and I appreciated that.
Oh, wow. Okay. I didn't know I had communicated with you before. I mean, I've really enjoyed some of the stuff you said in these past always record stuff. So I'm glad I responded.
You did. Yeah, it was a while ago. But I felt like that was and I don't skip ahead when I read articles. And so I thought that was going to be at the bottom. I thought you were going to have that picture and be like, boom, here it is. And yeah. Okay.
I guess to throw in some interpretations on, like, so why is Kubrick flipping these images? And this is all part of a metaphor that runs pretty deep, and it's one of the main focal points of the metaphor is the movie screen monolith correspondence, and all that kind of flows from there. There's an idea that I guess that might be worth sharing to kind of get it to kind of round out the significance of this. But the idea of metaphor, one of the best, I guess, descriptions of a metaphor is by Julian James. He wrote Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. I don't know if anyone's familiar with that, but I read that book around 2007, 2008. It's probably one of the best secular books on consciousness and spirituality / psychology that I've read. It's really, I actually have a copy of it here that even the beginning is just worth, I think, reading just because it's so poetic. So if that's okay with you, I should just take a minute. But
yeah, please go for it.
Okay, so the introduction. So this is Julian James writing on the problem of consciousness. Oh, what a world of unseen visions and heard silences, this insubstantial country of the mind. What ineffable essences, these touchless rememberings and unshowable reveries, and the privacy of it all. A secret theater of speechless monologue and previent counsel, an invisible mansion of all moods, musings, and mysteries, an infinite resort of disappointments and discoveries. A whole kingdom where each of us reigns reclusively alone, questioning what we will, commanding what we can. A hidden hermitage where we may study out the troubled book of what we have done and yet may do. An introcosm that is more myself than anything I can find in a mirror. This consciousness that is myself of selves, that is everything and yet nothing at all. What is it? And where did it come from and why? And then he gets into it. But one of the things he talks about is a metaphor, and he dissects a metaphor into four components. And so the example he gives in the book is, say, when to describe, say, the way that snow covers ground, one might say that the snow blankets the ground. So that would be an example of a metaphor. So he distinguishes two things. First, a metaphrand and a metaphier. And so the metaphrand in this case would be the snow. And the metaphier would be the way in which it covers the ground. So the use of metaphor is kind of like you use something which you and your audience already know ahead of time to describe something new. So we all generally have like an understanding of what a blanket is and that it's, you know, how it covers something. So that would be the main metaphrand and the metaphier. And then there's one or more paraphrand and paraphier pairs. So like, for example, the paraphier might be the softness of a blanket, and the paraphrand would be the softness of the snow. And again, another paraphrand might be the complete way in which a blanket, like when you throw a blanket on something, there's no splotches or anything. It's like a complete covering. And that also, the paraphier would be the complete covering of the snow onto the ground. And so with a very simple, you know, metaphor of just using blanket, you automatically get all these other accompanying features that help describe it, what you're trying to describe, right? So I think Kubrick has done this with the film analogy to, say, reality. And so the main, you might say, main metaphor is the, it's ultimately, I guess, the whole scope of a movie, right? So you have, which involves like a screen, you have a projector, you have an audience, you have the film, right? And then all everything that the correspondences that accompany that, all the paraphrand paraphier pairs that go into our experience of reality and the way in which, you know, some people can control others through it. So the how you might say it. So just jumping into, okay, what's the use of the flipping? So when say some people are projecting a certain reality onto the consciousness of either individuals or a country, right? If you buy into the movie, if you buy into the story and believe it, say if you then like you believe that there are 19 hijackers from the Middle East under the direction of Osama bin Laden had crashed into the World Trade Center towers, and that we need to go now attack people in the Middle East in order to protect ourselves from terrorism, right? If you buy into the movie, then you're a two-dimensional character within the film, and you can then be controlled. And this is, I think, what he's showing, that Frank Poole, who kind of believes, you might say, Hal's story, or just kind of believes what is surface level, because he's embedded within the film, he can be flipped back and forth. Like, you can pick up the film reel and look at it, flip it over in your hand, look at him from either side. And that's kind of what Hal is doing when he's looking at him, running around the hamster wheel in the beginning. And so anytime in the movie when you see the flipping happening, it corresponds to that. So it happened shortly before Frank Poole is murdered as well, when he's, you know, drifting out to work on the AE-35 unit. You know, he's buying into the movie, and so he's a character in it, and he's controlled by it, and then he's killed by it. So just to throw it out there.
Oh man! So like the month in which I read this, I was studying the clephotic tree being a mirror of Tetragrammaton, and how they relate the four layers of clepote to the death penalties. And so there was something really interesting that was coming up. First of all, you have this whole mirror thing, but then combined with the anagram actually of Hollywood, or Defy Hollywood. Are you familiar with Alejandro Jodorowsky's The Holy Mountain?
No, not.
Okay. It's one of my absolute favorite films. In the first place, but there's a synchronicity I found with Marilyn Manson did an album called Hollywood. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
Okay, so that album goes in sync in ridiculously well with The Holy Mountain. And if you look at the front of the album Hollywood, you have Marilyn Manson pictured on the cross. So he's being crucified. And like, even as I'm saying this, just in my head, I'm thinking about Clockwork Orange when he says, you know, who speaking to Alex, who as a boy, who, you know, those who would be crucified rather than crucify, you know, like what they're aiming for with the libido technique. But it's easy to go on tangents here, but I couldn't help but the whole time after your article relating it, as like, if you're going to relate to the tree of life as a substitute holographic version of the tree of life, rather than relating to your true self, it works through projection. And so everything is in reverse. And so there's something that happens throughout your writing here where you can see the way that like Frank will be flying in the opposite direction. And because he misinterpreted it, he goes in the other direction. If I remember that correctly, it's been a while.
Frank or David?
Frank is flying, and so David goes to save him. And because he looks at the computer screen and sees him going one way, he's actually going the other. He's been manipulated. And so there's like these layers of manipulation that the characters are having to work through in order to act accordingly, right?
Yeah. So, If I may real quick, I mean, just the fact that we've brought it to the esoterica, I mean... you guys have talked about the fact that while Dave is flying to save Frank, while he's basically trapped outside, there will be repeatedly flashed up on the screen the letters M-E-M, Mem. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, that's the Hanged Man in Tarot.
So I was going to say, that's the Hanged Man, exactly. So Mem is the Hebrew letter that corresponds to the Hanged Man of the Tarot. What is the significance of the Hanged Man? It's a reversal of perception.
Right.
Right. I mean, we've discussed the Hanged Man in other ways, of all of the water symbolism, the death symbolism, etc., etc. But another really central part of that archetype is the idea of a reversal of perception. Mm. So for him to be having this Hanged Man letter flashing upon his face while he's suffering from a complete reversal of imagery, to me, really, I don't know, if, you know, again, everything here, it's so hard to say if it's what's intentional, what's not, but it would really seem to validate whether intentional or not. It would really strengthen your argument. I just want to throw that out there.
Yeah, the whole, you know, projecting even letters onto the face, I mean, that has to be intentional, because as we all know, any computer screen that one is looking at, you don't have the image projected on your face when you're looking at it. So it has to be at least the projection of something definitely intentional. So, yeah.
Are you familiar with Sri Ramana Maharshi?
No.
He's like a Vedantic teacher. And he is, as far as I know, the first person to lay out this projector movie theater as a metaphor for consciousness. And he went into like, he would, people have taken what he said and represented it in various diagrams to show you the theater and then the self, and it gets a little complicated sometimes because it's, you know, Vedanta, but he's communicating everything that you're describing, but in the 1930s. So it's kind of interesting.
Okay. Yeah. Just to add to the whole projection motif, I don't know if both of you have seen, I think Alan has, I think you confirmed it via email, but Jay Widener's, I think he put it out in the past few years, the Kubrick's Odyssey.
Mm-hmm.
And he focuses a lot on this technique of front screen projection and how that was used. It seems like, well, a lot of evidence that was used in filming the moon landings. You know, I can't say I'm convinced one way or the other that, you know, was Kubrick involved with filming the moon landings or not. But nonetheless, I mean, Widener puts together a very compelling argument. I'd recommend people to check that out.
On that note, however, David mentioned John Fel Ryan just shared on Facebook this, and this was an older Vanity Fair article that was put online. And this is, I think the article was written, I don't know, around 2000 or so. If I remember, it was like just shortly after Kubrick's death.
It was just before Eyes Wide Shut was released in theaters.
Yes, you're right. So regardless, one of the quotes in there that really struck me in relation to Jay Widener is the guy makes a comment about what Kubrick thought of, why can't I think of the guy's name? Alfred Hitchcock. It was said, Kubrick thought Alfred Hitchcock wasn't that impressive and made some sort of comment about using too much front screen projection bullshit.
Yeah.
Or something like that. And that quote jumped off the page at me
totally. Because
of the Jay Widener thing.
Right. Yeah, what film was he referring it to? Any specific Kubrick film where Kubrick was using front screen projection?
No, he was just commenting on Alfred Hitchcock.
Okay. Yeah, because according to Jay, Kubrick was also using that technique in a lot of the scenes in Eyes Wide Shut, you know, which is a bit surprising in and of itself, just because front screen projection is such an old technology, it's rarely used, from my understanding.
Yeah, it could be totally ironic that the fact that this article is coming out, in a sense, the guy who talked about how the article was written was right before Kubrick died. He had already started writing it as promotion for Eyes Wide Shut, and then Kubrick died, and it turns into half obituary, half promotion for the movie. And it could be ironic, or even, again, a false flag, is to say, oh, fuck Hitchcock using front screen projection, when, of course, he's using the same thing.
Hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying? It could be a total red herring.
Okay.
Why shock and awe? Are you making a reference to the shocking awe?
That term was used a lot in during the our invasion of Iraq. At around that time. I mean, I was just borrowing a term that they used in on the news. I mean, I don't know if that was actually an official name of an operation. I think it might have been.
Wow.
But, yeah, I was aware of that, of the connection to the Shakina as well. I mean, there. So it's
a number of people have made that connection. So during during the original Iraqi invasion, it was basically like almost like a blitzkrieg type thing. They're talking about, we're gonna just overwhelm them instead of it was part of a guarantee of there won't be a long protracted military thing. We're just gonna blitz the crap out of them in what they were kept calling shock and awe.
It's because it's a dick. So they're taking that as the tip of the thing, because that's the Malkut is the Shakina, and so it's a joke. And so I've been aware of
that. Iraq is Babylon. But, I mean, it's so totally. This has been discussed many, many, not just on this show, but a number of researchers and conspiracy theorists and so on have talked about this idea of the shock and awe being a very literal or a very tongue-in-cheek reference, that it's impossible that they didn't realize that.
If you watch Will Ferrell's presentation of George Bush, like his, I don't know, he did a performance. You know, there's a part in it where he points at a picture of the penis and he says, that's some shock and awe right there. And then it's back to back with a Gollum reference where he says that little Jewish person, Gollum, which is a joke because Gollum is, in Judaism, you create a golem, you know, you create a moon child. I thought that was really, I don't know. I'm like, really, Will Ferrell, is someone writing your stuff for you here? Or are you just on it? Or is that just the way that the universe works? But, yeah. Pretty ironic.
So, you know, but along those lines, we have, We do, of course, have Millennium Hilton showing up. We have all these things that end up playing out in this way. My question to you, Matt, is either at the height of your paranoia or years, and again, I really mean that. I don't mean that insultingly.
Yeah.
But I'm saying at that stage, because you made a comment earlier that watching this movie at any stage of your life, you see it through that lens. And this is what I think the genius of all of Kubrick's movies is, they are a mirror. This is why in The Shining, Danny, you know, you look in the mirror and it's red rum, or in the mirror it's, you know, it's murder. What is it? It's totally a mirror, and you're going to see yourself reflected back at you anytime you view a piece of media. And Kubrick, I think, understood this better than anyone. But so I totally agree. I can watch this movie every few years and get a completely different reading of it. But I'm curious if at any point in any of your readings of it, did you think Kubrick was telling you to defy Hollywood and maybe aware of these false flags trying to warn people? Or was there ever a point in which you thought possibly he's in on it, in the sense of, you know, having this 2001, the actual 9/11 real world event, so echoing this movie? You know, do you ever ponder that side of it?
I do, and you know, it's similar to other works of art. I mean, if we think, for lack of a better term, if we call it the information field or whatnot, I mean, anytime someone writes a very compelling work of fiction, you know, are they tapping into something else? And I know you guys are familiar with this concept, and I've heard you guys talk about it. And so whether or not Kubrick, like any great artist, is kind of tapping into maybe the collective unconscious in the Jungian sense, or maybe he was tipped off that some kind of major event was scheduled for 9/11. You may not have known exactly the details of it, you know, or maybe it's a combination of both. I don't know. That's the brief answer.
That's why I like your style, and that's why I really enjoyed this article. It's because there's so many people that will have their angle on it, and they're just either they're negating everyone else's ideas and they feel that theirs is the answer, or they're just, you know, they're really attached to this being what it is, and you leave it open as this possibility. And Rob Agger does the same thing, and it's why I really like his work, is because he's able to maneuver that, and he's okay with being in a gray area a lot of the time.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I would say Rob Eggers not paranoid enough, though. I mean, it seemed like he has been saying more recently than before that, you know, he's looked into whether or not the Illuminati are there and doesn't find, like, it's almost like he doesn't believe in a global conspiracy, which I'm sure that, you know, I think that's that viewpoint has its place within an overall well-balanced kind of forum. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's those different ideas out there,
Yeah, or they're not as organized as people might take it to be. Or coordinated might be the word.
Another thought, I guess, to throw in, like, maybe part of the reason why Kubrick's and all great art, the reason they have this timeless quality, it's almost like, you know, if one is able to kind of dig deep enough into the archetypes and bring this out, then there is this much, you know, even, you know, I might say, like, even a metaphysical kind of theme that they're tapping into. So then naturally it's going to resonate with different people or even the same person at different times in their lives. And to kind of to take these timeless archetypes and to manifest it in a timely way, then it makes that connection.
Yeah. Well, I see, like, the argument that you're making is just like it can extend as deep as you want, wherever you want to apply it, it's the same principle. So whether you're talking about false flag in the political sense, you could also be talking about it in the mystical sense. And I don't actually see much of a conflict between the two. They feel like extensions of each other, because without us manipulating ourselves internally, we wouldn't be able to play this game out, this global game that we're all participating in the way that we are. They're completely connected as far as I can tell. And I see that in 2001, because he's showing you that this is evolution itself, and yet here's how it's expressing itself through relationship, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. And there are a couple questions I had, I wanted to ask each of you, and this, I don't mean to steer we could get into this later or whenever, if this is appropriate, David, I wanted to ask, and you could take as much time to, answer this, but what is the Kabbalistic tree of life? And this is coming from someone who doesn't, like, my only background in the tree of life is, you know, what I might read on Wikipedia or some other stuff, some like kind of, you know, freely available kind of things.
So when I study the Zohar, we just jump right in. So we'll take something and we'll start looking at it. And so, I mean, I've been doing this now, I don't know, I know it's over 6 years, it might be closer to seven, with my teacher regularly, and I don't know. And I have all these different ideas, and they keep shifting, and they keep changing, and so, and then if you ask my rabbi, he's like, I don't know. But there's different ideas I have that I would be happy to communicate that are only matters of inference from my study. I see this common theme, which honestly, like, as far as I can tell, feels like it's describing a vacuum. So, like, basically distribution of energy. It's definitely seems to be saying something about energy, because it's what is the unseen mover or the thing that's animating us, and that it's also seems to be suggesting dynamics. Because they're dynamic and everything is moving in relationship to the other, so it's like compensating. So, and it's definitely about form. So, like, the Sefer Yetzirah is literally the book of formation. So that's how it translates, and that's the main place where the tree of life is described in older text. And it's, you know, it's a way of relating to ourselves, I guess, and it's a way of relating to the Torah. And seeing how the Torah translates more, that you're like basically interacting with a story, so it's no longer a story in the sense that we normally relate to a story, just in the same sense that you could be, you know, a spectator, or you could be in the thing that you're spectating. This is why when I see what you and Edgar are saying in terms of the monolith being the television screen or the movie theater screen, excuse me, that you're in the thing you're watching. Like, you're not separate from, there is no, like, observer separate from the observation. And this is something that seems to be emphasized in the Zohar.
Do you mind if I just jump in here real quick? Sure. I think I have, and you could totally disagree with this, but I think I might have a fairly easy, concise way of saying
sure,
this.
Sure.
So, Andras Jones wrote this book called Accidental Initiations in the Tree of, in the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. And I helped him with, and what I really liked about it was that breaking down each section of the tree, just relating to it as a time in his life, saying these are types of energies or ways that these things kind of play out. So there's, someone's been able to do this and just show a really kind of like, this is how one could experience these types of energies. But regardless, what he, the way he describes the Tree of Life is a map of consciousness. And what David's saying here is a very similar idea of saying this is, it has to do with how energies are distributed and this sort of stuff. And if you could almost think of it, if you're familiar with, like, say, a chakra system or something, right? Like, oh, this is a way of saying this energy is here, this energy is here, this energy is here. Or maybe a more complex version of that. Or if you look at a map of the solar system, you can say, okay, here's where Earth is, here's where Mars is, here's where the Sun is. But just the same way, when he's saying, if you looked at that map of the solar system, you have to realize those bodies are in movement, and you're inside of it. So the thing you're looking at, you're inside of.
Sure.
And it will give you, but it's a way of kind of saying, if you can understand this energy kind of does this thing here, and kind of does this thing here, and it's, if you almost use it as a map or a almost a sort of source code for how these archetypes play out, both in art and in the real world and perhaps on these higher spiritual planes, etc., etc. Would you agree with that, David?
Yeah.
As a kind of oversimplified, but...
Oh, no, that's really well said. There's one thing really worth emphasizing that gets emphasized in the Zohar, and that's that the Tree of Life is also the Tetragrammaton. So, and the Tetragrammaton is not, like, we relate to four letters as the closest thing to something that's indescribable. To actually pronounce the name is your own ending. It's like the accomplishment of the great work is synonymous with pronouncing the name, but we cannot pronounce the name as we are in form. So to pronounce the name is actually to lose the form that it exists within currently and to become something else entirely. And so it sounds a little far out, but that's, I mean, you, so in the same sense...
Unless you're watching 2001 A Space Odyssey, in which Dave Bowman becomes a completely different form.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the thing, is like in 2001 you can see it as that they move through four worlds. There's four sections to the film, truly. So that, you know, you're on Earth, so you have Malkuth, and then you go through the worlds, and it's all been... I mean, multiple people have laid that out, you know, and I feel like it's totally reasonable. You can see you're moving up the tree, and you cross the abyss that's beyond the infinite, you know. So basically, you can't relate to the tree other than a substitute if you're creating or if you're making something in form to represent it, and it can't be represented truly. So it's always going to be, that's the idea of the Klipo, is that our personality, our projected self, is ultimately an illusion, that we, it's a, like a way of relating to something that's beyond our ability to, you know, if we understand it truly, then we become it, and all of our representations become meaningless. And so relating to the tree as such, to represent the tree, is never the tree, you know.
Have either of you ever seen the movie Schenectady, New York?
No, I know the city, but no.
It's a play on the word Schenectady, like the city. There's a movie called Schenectady, which is basically means... like a model representation, another, you know, a kind of, it's like a mix of metaphor and and model. So basically, it's a super depressing movie. So I don't necessarily recommend it. But if you realize the movie basically is this guy who wants to make a film about his life, so he gets this actor to play him and all this sort of stuff, and then he makes a set that looks like his apartment and so on, so on. And then he decides, okay, that's good, but I actually want to make a movie within a movie, so I want to make the actors that are playing me are now part of me. So I have a set in which is actually the film set. And he ends up building so many layers of the representation, it becomes, you know, like 40-something layers deep, that he has a warehouse. It almost becomes like the Truman Show. You have this giant set, and inside that set are smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller sets, and he loses touch of which one is the actor playing his girlfriend or which one is the actress playing the actress who's playing the actress who's playing the actress that's playing his girlfriend. And it's, you know, in that respect, it's a really, really amazing psychedelic or just thought-provoking exercise. But I wonder if, David, that's kind of when you're saying any attempt to represent it is almost pushing you further into a physical representation and not what it actually is?
Yeah, there's a whole thing that gets repeated in the Zohar that's kind of can make one uneasy, which is that in a certain sense, the way that the klipot work is that you can have a real sense that you're making progress, but really you're going deeper into the illusion. Though, if you go far enough, you come out the other side, apparently. It's just like, whichever direction you're going, you got to go all the way, so to speak. So it's kind of interesting, because I guess if you go far enough if you are pulling apart an illusion enough, you know, you can end up breaking it apart. You could be doing it another way too, through austerity, or like a sense of abstinence when it comes to how, you know, far you want to go with your practice. Like, I mean, yoga works the same way, you know. That I felt like that was really well represented in the film The Fountain, which was inspired greatly by 2001, admittedly so, and Kabbalah, where you have these two different directions being expressed, and that they're actually mutually interdependent. So the farther you go into form, you know, there's a liberation that happens through that, when he eats of the tree of life and has flowers grow up out of him, and he becomes one with the thing. And in that is a union. That is a sense of yoga. And on the other side, you have him going in the sphere higher and higher. And so that's like, you know, sublimation. So it can go either way, I guess. It's all the same in the end.
I've heard you guys make correspondences between the Tarot and the Tree of Life. And so I know there's, you know, 22 major arcana in the Tarot, and then you have the 22 connections between the 10 spherot of the Tree of Life. Is there a strict kind of one-to-one mapping between the two, or is it more loose?
Well, in the Sefer Yetzirah, they represent the pathways a certain way, and they take the letters and they attribute them to the different ways that they're angled, and relate to them that way, though there's discrepancies on exactly how to do that as well, because the letters are actually compartmentalized differently, so there's different sets, and then those get applied. But the European occultists do have a strict way of representing it, where it's representing the lightning flash that goes down the tree. So one really important thing to know about the tree, if you're asking about it, is that it's totally the Fibonacci sequence. You can find the Fibonacci sequence in the Torah, referenced in relationship to the tree. If you ever see the film Pi, they explain that pretty well. So it's, if it's a tree, how is a tree? What are the dynamics of the tree? The segments of the tree are the Fibonacci sequence, in the same way that our body is 1, 1, 1, 2, or 3, 5, 8, 13, 24, whatever. You know, so you have the way that things branch out. Lightning is the same as a tree, is the same as our physical body. So what's being pointed to but our own dynamics of expression, which have infinite variety, but at the same time have the underlying consistency. If that makes sense. Did I answer your question, or did I go on a tangent?
I get the sense it's not a strict correspondence, but there's some resonances, I guess.
Yeah, well, for the European occultists, they're pretty consistent. So, like, the Golden Dawn system gets applied for the OTO, and so the mystery schools have kind of arranged their own way of relating to it, which I feel there's a really good argument for. And so even though initially, like, with my rabbi when we were discussing these things, and I bring it to the table repeatedly what the tarot associations are, which he's not as familiar with because he's far more traditional, you know. But he can recognize what I'm getting at and why there's certain ways that the pathways show up that are actually more appropriate than I think a lot of Jews would know unless if they studied it. So I tend to lean towards more of a lot of the traditional takes on Kabbalah, but I can really appreciate the Europeans' angle a lot of the time. The pathways are one place in particular that I resonate more with their take than I do the traditional, if that makes sense.
Okay, so is it actual, like, each tarot corresponds to exactly one of the pathways and vice versa?
Well, each tarot card corresponds to a letter and by extension the pathways.
I see, okay.
So, yeah.
Right, so that number 22 will continually come up because there's 22 paths, there's 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet, and there's 22 trumps of what they call the major arcana of the tarot. So there's that number is sort of, you know, to me this is, it's in one sense it's splitting hairs because you have like the I Ching will say it's 64 hexagrams, the Tarot will say it's 78 different archetypes, you know, the Tree of Life you could say it's either the 10 Sephiroth or plus the 22 pads making 32. You know, it's like what number do you want to agree on that it can be boiled down to, almost, to at least in my understanding, is a fool's argument. It's like the periodic table of elements is really how I think of all these things, is periodic table of elements. And you could say, well, there's this number might represent all the things that we can find on Earth, but then there might be some other synthetic elements, or there could be, you know, other elements that are newly discovered, et cetera, et cetera. Or these might fall more into this category, these might fall more into this category. But if you sort of think of it that way, as there's so many archetypes that can play out in any situation, and these are just handy sort of charts or graphs for how that might work. But in much the same way, looking at a periodic table of elements and saying this is what gold is and this is how it relates to this isn't the same thing as actually making gold or having gold or even being gold.
Right.
But all these things, I think, are attempts to sort of quantify or, add some structure to these concepts. And I think it's the concept that's really important, not necessarily the number. Although, there is value to all these numbers, which maybe this is... I didn't want to do this too much today, but I was kind of hoping... Oh, fuck it, I'll just say it. You do this, you have as Matt, you are writing for bluescience.org, correct?
Yes.
And we've spoken to another gentleman from that site, his name is John McGuire. I believe that was episode 65 of Always Record.
Okay. Yeah, listen to that.
And so when I've had a number of conversations with John, only one of them were recorded. And what he says to me is that he finds what we're doing interesting because he's interested in this more scientific approach, and yet what he keeps finding is that these ancient structures for how to map things out are actually relevant to what he's trying to figure out, as if someone either had some of this knowledge in the past or was tapping into it on some other level, the way an artist might tap into these archetypes, etc., and that there's an uncanny amount of correspondence between these esoteric schools and the more Western scientific approach, which is probably why it was considered a science in the first place. You know, it was only in the last few hundred years that we've split it up. But I know you're also interested in this, and I just want to say, if that's possibly why you're asking, or maybe we can go in that direction a little bit, these numbers do seem to come up a lot. You know, you have, like, I believe it was Tesla said, you know, if we could understand the numbers 3, 6, and 9, you could basically figure anything out, if you could figure out how they correspond. There's we've had a gentleman on named Zenor who did an article recently talking about there was, I'm probably screwing this up, I believe the number was 271, that these few quantum physicists like have this puzzle why this number shows up as often as it does, and this is one of the biggest mysteries of modern physics, is this, why does this number keep showing up in all of their equations?
Is it 137?
Yes, 137.
Yeah. 1 over exactly. 137, yeah, the fine structure constant.
Exactly, yeah. So in this respect, understanding the significance of these numbers, or why certain esoteric schools pick these numbers, might actually have some value in that kind of work. And yet, I would also stress, don't get too hung up on a specific number, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I had written about is as an option, if we want to go in this direction, is one thing I've been interested in for many years has been like the philosophical foundations of mathematics and truth, and like the question of what is truth, you know, generally, but also in the strict mathematical sense. And this has led into results like Russell's paradox, and perhaps the most profound being what's known as Gödel's theorem. And there do seem to be these archetypes that manifest within these results, and which, you know, from a bird's eye point of view, shouldn't be too surprising, because if we're examining the fundamental foundations of truth, it's ultimately going to be a reflection of our own minds, and thereby, if our own minds are constructed from these archetypes, we're going to see the archetypes mirrored into these results. And there's a PowerPoint that I've given a number of times that I could talk for 3 hours on this kind of stuff. I could try to put it into a nutshell, that's one possible doorway if you want to go down. And another one is what's the law of one, also referred to as the raw material. It's a series of 106 channeled sessions from 1981 to 1984 that for me personally, I've found it to provide perhaps some of the greatest or most satisfying spiritual sustenance, you might say. And it's something I read daily. I mean, I read it even this morning over breakfast. It's talked about a whole number of things, one of which are the archetypes and their representations within the Tree of Life, the Tarot, and astrology, actually. And it hints at connection between them. It goes deep into the Tarot, because the entity which is being channeled gave this option to the three channelers as far as what direction they wanted to go in, and they chose the Tarot. And so I know most about the Tarot, at least from that angle. So I think that's what was largely, well, that's one thing that was, I was interested in the correspondences, because even on the surface level, you have this repeating theme of 10 and 22 with all three of these things, right? You have, well, obviously the Tree of Life, right? The 10 Sphero, I don't know if I'm, Sphero?
Sphero, yeah.
It's Sphero. Okay. Yeah. Okay, and then the 22 connections. Okay, and then in the major arcana, you have the 22 cards. But the way that the system in the Law of One, it arranges this, it puts the first 21 into a 3x7 grid. You might say that, at least that's the easiest way to.
Do you say 3x7?
Yeah, I think I might.
So 777, which is the numerical representation of the lightning flash down the tree that David was talking about. So it's probably not an accident why it's 3x7.
Okay.
Totally.
I'm going to send you a link right now. You feel free to put, you know, add this to the site if you want. But it says, so it arranges it into, like, the first seven cards numbered 1 through 7, it would categorize that as, there's three main categories, mind, body, spirit. So the first 3 7 is under mind, second 7 is under body, third 7 is under spirit, and then each of those seven, you might say category or aspects, can be, it identifies it as either, as well, as the matrix, the potentiator, the catalyst, the experience, the significator, the transformation, and the great way. And so, like, for instance, card number 1 would be the matrix of the mind. Card number 2 would be potentiator of the mind, then the catalyst of the mind, etc. Card number 8 would be matrix of the body, then potentiator of the body, etc. And then finally, for the card number 15 would be matrix of the spirit, then you have potentiator of the spirit up until card 21, which would be the great way of the spirit. And then finally, the last card, number 22, which is often called the fool, but in the raw material, it's referred to as the choice. And it goes into it, and this is not the main foundation, this is not the main substance of these channeled workings, but it goes into a fair amount of detail, some more than others, on the nature of the cards and the its relationship to it as a representation of the archetypical mind, as it's called, and what I've read so far on you know, the Tree of Life, it's also kind of this mapping. It's like it's the kind of the, I don't know, the it's to not kind of go over what we already said, I mean, it's very much in line with what you were saying earlier, Alan. So it's entirely consistent with that. And then in the astrology, you also have these repeating themes of 10 and 22, because you have, well, for one, the 12 signs of the zodiac, but then the 10 heavenly bodies being the 8 planets, right? You have, very quickly, was it Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, that being 8, and then you add the 2 for the sun and the moon. So you have these 10 heavenly bodies, and then you add that to the 12, so you have the 10 there, and then you add that to the 12 signs of the zodiac, you again get the 22. And so that's also kind of a more, you might say, dynamic or real-time working of the archetypical mind, in progress. So, Law of One is also something that I can talk a fair amount about. But I mean, tying it back to because what we're talking about here is archetypes, and this is what Kubrick seems to be putting to a lot of his films. Yeah, just to throw some material out there.
If you don't mind, what I was going to say, is that I would like, what I'd really like to do, if you're up for this, is today maybe we can kind of course we can incorporate some of this stuff, but I was thinking maybe today we'll keep it a little more Kubricky, and then what I'd really like is if we could, I speak to John every now and then, maybe we could have both you and John on a show together, and because I think the same way you're kind of asking us questions about some of the esoteric stuff, I think we'd be able to ask you questions more about this, the other side of this, the more scientific side of this, and I feel like you guys would probably be able to feed off each other in a way that's probably a lot more vital, because I wouldn't even know a lot of the questions to ask in that respect, if you know what I mean. So if you're up for that, I was thinking that might be a cool possibility, is maybe, like, in a few weeks, we just see if we can find a day that both you and John are available and have you both together.
Sure. Yeah, sounds good.
That's a great idea. I've been scrolling through this Vanity Fair article from Kubrick, because I don't feel like I would give it as good of justice, but I don't seem to be finding it, where he talks about, he had asked his friend if he was familiar with Carl Jung and specifically his idea of the shadow. And then he says, well, I'm thinking about making a war film that has that as its subtext. And so that's an example of, like, a clear documented case from Kubrick where first he had the subtext and then he's like, how can I communicate this? So like the story and everything else comes after the initial thing. And in this case, it's Jung. And so the fact that, like, I love how if you watch The Shining in the theater and if you look closely at Ullman's desk, you can see the Red Book there before it was ever published, meaning he's hip to it. There's a book called The Rabbi's Tarot by a woman named Daphne Moore, where she takes a manuscript and does kind of a creative writing way of communicating what's in the manuscript of one of Jung's very close disciples communicating everything that Jung had to say about the truly esoteric stuff in tarot relating to Kabbalah. And so, like, that is, like, suggesting that if you go deep enough into Jung, if you're, you know, interested enough in Jung, you're going to come across these how he was relating to these archetypes in terms of tarot straight up relating it to the Hebrew letters. And so, like, that actually is a strong argument for, and I mean, he's Jewish. It just, it makes so much sense, and it sure would explain a lot. So I thought it was worth putting that out there.
And I also want to stress again that this is a very informal show, and very often this is probably a more structured show than we usually have. The only reason I kind of try to do this one a little more structured is because I know there's two areas in which I'd really like to kind of dig into your brain on, one being Kubrick, one being the Blue Science. And I feel like if we kind of took those one at a time, we can really dig deep. But I just, again, throw the door completely open is this show, we go on tangents. If a tangent strikes you that you want to delve into, please don't hesitate.
Right. Okay. I'm itching to get into Russell's paradox.
Then do it.
Yeah?
Okay, here's something new. Hope I can remember it all. This is January 4th, 1990. The first song of this decade, I believe. Well, Robin had a rough night the other night at the 8121, out all night having funny. Arose from bed with a ringing in his head and the room was filled with sun. The clock said 1:30, so he went to wash his face and he said, what's wrong with the mirror? I ought to have it replaced. Whoa, what's wrong with the mirror? I'm not looking so great these days. And some stubble had grown across his face. Overnight, he could see it in the light. So he grabbed the blade and he rolled down the shades, saying, the light's too much for me. And since he couldn't see, he went and cut his face. And he said, what's wrong with the mirror? I ought to have it replaced. Oh, what's wrong with the mirror? I'm not looking so great. And when you hear this story, you gotta laugh, 'cause you know that it can't be true. I mean, it is so absurd. He hadn't been protected, and as he slipped away, he said, just a basic idea.